Hi, and good morning to you. I'm not exactly sure which number we're on at the moment. Maybe Michael can look that up. I know it is, however, the 17th today. It's our reappearance of the Christ Day, but we'll not be holding that later because we have a new moon meditation. And that will be at 10 o'clock GMT this morning. So right now it's 5 a.m. GMT, and that will be another few hours, another 5 hours. And then in the evening at 6 p.m., we will have GMT again. We will have the EUN, and I think that Michael will be putting that in the chat box. So some of you may know what that's all about, basically invoking the souls of nations. And if one wants to continue with it, then a kind of commitment or a pledge is necessary that lasts all of the way until we reach 2026, the new group of world servers special festival. Always,
Michael,
yes, Michael.
this is the 15th program of this series of Identify as Being.
Right. Okay, very good. Thank
Okay.
you, Michael. 15th. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm going to have to find a way to, because I'm using not one single document, I'm using a number of documents. So 15th program. I'll just put that down for the moment and I'll take care of it later. And this is a 15th program in series 4 of IAB. I think that's how we can look at that. Anyway, those of you who come along to this particular presentation, which is in a way quite different from the usual DK presentation, although he does hint at it, you know, if you really look at what he's saying, it's hinted, but it's considered to be difficult. And so at first, we simply have to learn the ropes. But meanwhile, I am proposing that we also have at least this one webinar per week, which deals with the factor of being, a kind of an ontological approach, the science of being. And I've been sending out to you every day a seed or two, or three or four. Of the infinite seed thoughts that you can ponder at your leisure. I think it's not wise for me to force the way one would ponder these things because the door, the open sesame, is different for everybody. So I just will see how you do and what sort of ideas you may come up with, or what kind of registrations you may come up with. That is the, I think, important thing. What kind of experiences may come to you as a result of using these seed thoughts. Okay, now I just want to welcome those of you who are here. And always grateful for Michael's help in all these matters. And Anna, good morning, and Annette. And let's see if I can, Catherine, good morning. And Joe Waltz is on our communications team. Thank you, Joe, for being here. Karen, hi, and Leslie, hi, and Martine, and Tia, and Miro. Good morning to all of you. It's morning here. We expected a big storm, with waves that were 21 feet high or something like that. But it didn't, it must have jumped over us or something. So we hope that it remains that way. Otherwise the electricity will be out, you know. It is suspended at the moment, so I'm glad of that. So hi, everybody, and now we'll review a little bit in the method that I use, which is, what can I call it? It's kind of partially lecture, partially meditation, that as we go along, we pause and reflect. And I think that may be the best way to absorb things. I'm not going to begin with the one that I sent you yesterday. I think it's pretty difficult, but we may come back to it. Just for the moment, though, we have a simple one, a simple seed thought. And we can say, you know, think or thinking, we can say, okay, I've got to get this correct. And that's finish. And that's when you're working with two keyboards at the same time, you know. And we have the idea of thinking globally. That is how it is usually expressed. And acting locally. All right. Well, that's, we're all familiar with that. And we carry in our consciousness as much of the world as may be possible. But now I have a little adaptation of it. Think infinitely and act finitely. Well, all we can do is cast our thought in the direction of infinity and realize that we are little emanations presently of the one universal self in this universe. There have been, according to the great breath, it has been endless, beginningless and endless. So there are some things here. I'd like us to pause for a moment and see what it may mean for us to extend our thought in the direction of infinity. No one of us is going to really think infinitely, but we can at least extend our thought in that direction. And then to realize that every act that we perform with deliberation within this universe is in fact a finite act within a finite universe. I mean, if the great breath is a true example of the great archetype of existence and pralaya, existence and pralaya, then no universe can be infinite. It has to be finite, and everything that goes on within it is a finitude. But let's just pause for a little while and see if we can align with the higher intuitive aspects of our nature, which are much more likely to have a slight grasp of a tendency towards infinity. See, what really is it if we begin to think of that which lies beyond and includes everything that we can possibly think of or perceive. This will take us to the realization that we can never escape this, it's kind of a state above that of the universe. I call it supra-universal, or super-universal, supra-universal, above. We're so used to thinking about the dynamics of the universe, and we have so much to learn in that respect, of course. However, different from the mathematicians who simply deal with infinity as if it were some kind of calculation and an extension of their mathematics, we are dealing with it as if it were a great reality, not just thoughts, but a great ontological, having to do with being, a great reality. And I guess when we have in the consciousness the notion that everything we do and think and feel, you know, all the things that we do in this universe are just the tiniest part of infinite possibility. And whose possibility is it, really? We should not dichotomize. We should not say, well, there is the fact of infinity and then there is I. Or, you know, here I am and I'm separate from that. I'm not. We're always looking for our identity in a deep metaphysical sense, at least from the ancient Vedic days and probably long before that. And that identity is a very expansive thing. It's not what we think we are, which is, in a way, a great reduction of what we really are. So, essentially, we are this supra-universal infinitude. You know, you're used to thinking of yourself in a certain, very limited way. And for work within the great Mahamaya, the great illusion of the universe, we have to think that way. You know, you have to think at first as a personality, and later as a soul-infused personality, and later as a soul walking the earth through the personality. There's many ways to think of what we are. But if on occasion we could drop those usual thoughts, and expand our sense of identity, we would find that we are living, moving, breathing, being through every perception. The perception of people, once DK talked about phantasmagoria. You may want to look it up in your Alice Bailey CD-ROM. I think there may be only one reference. Let's see if I can find it. And if I do, I'll put us onto it. Well, there are a few references. And we're part of this phantasmagoria. The dweller on the threshold is part of it. Alice Bailey is speaking of the ever-shifting phantasmagoria of thought. But this is the one. Impersonality. Now, basically, we are working on that. And here's what DK says about it, which is very interesting, I think. Impersonality is possible only to the disciple who knows truly how to love. And to him who sees life and its phantasmagoria, including all associated persons, in the light of the spiritual triad. And that's the line, including all associated persons. So that when we look on at our personhood, and the personhood of others, it's still part of the illusory phantasmagoria, and maybe in the spiritual triad, probably beginning with the Buddhic level, some seeing through of this phantasmagoria can occur. So, you know, it's not practical to go around and think of yourself always as the infinite being, but really there is nothing else. And so from time to time we have to remind ourselves. And I have a question here. I say, what would it take to let nothing in universe and really escape your I-ness with that number 8? It's kind of it's a way of saying we are both that which is above and that which is below. What if every perception that you had in universe could not escape into otherness? I'll put it down. No escape into, and I'll other than you-ness. Now, this is called, you know, solipsism. And it means the one alone. And it's not highly regarded in philosophy, you know, because so much of philosophy is just about thought. We want this to be about experience. So let's ponder this a little bit. What would it take to let nothing that you perceive escape its being yourself? Escape. I'll fix that. It's being yourself. What would it take? And just ponder for a little bit here. Because it's an odd thought, you know, that all of these many, many things that are perceived are just another version of yourself, essentially. You have to feel that every one of your perceptions is permeated and by your selfhood and takes its origin from your selfhood. Now, this is a lot different than the what and how approach to the universe. What's going on? How does it work? I mean, yes, of course. We have to know those things, and on the way to universal omniscience, we will gradually recognize all of these many interactive factors, and we'll discover what can be known on the higher planes, of course. That is true. But I'm just speaking now at the raw level of identification, which involves the heart center, which is the first of the Buddhic organs. And it is a factor of inclusiveness. Now, you know, we're told about how the masters have developed inclusiveness, and especially those who are on the Jupiterian, Neptunian second ray. They end up including everything. Until they can say, naught is but me. And not to say it, but know experientially that every perception is really not only a reflection of themselves, but it is themselves. So maybe another way of looking at this, well, you know, we can tell ourselves different things, different mantras that work for us, to apprehend these matters. If I say to a tree or a plant that I'm looking at, you do not escape me. And if it has a impressive quality upon my consciousness, it is useful. You may have to wait a little bit before it gels. At least I do sometimes. I say the mantra, whatever I may cook up, you know. And then the beingness of the perception becomes the outstanding factor and not the quality of the perception. That's such an important factor. Now, you know, where we are in our evolution, the soul is the quality of life and life quality and appearance, and we're certainly working on quality. We're certainly trying to improve the quality according to soul design, improve the quality of everything in our environment and in our life. Certainly we are. I'm not discounting those things at all, but I'm giving a different emphasis here. And very subtle, to shift back and forth between quality, form, and beingness. The ontological dimension, which every perception shares identically. The mere fact that it is perceived tells you that it is on some level, and it's the isness we're looking for. I sometimes joke, and I call it, you know, isification. Are you isified? That's the idea of perceiving in God or not perceiving in God. And the shift can be instantaneous, and it can last but a fleeting moment at first. And as I've said, we call this the blinking of the dragon's eye. So we have to register the is layer of whatever is perceived. To fall into quality is necessary most of the time. I study this, I study that, I learn about this. I learn about interplay and the science of relations. But there is a layer of identicality which is due to shared isness, the shared isness of all things. And that's what it means in the old sense, to see in God. There are things as they seem, I have here in front of me, and there are things in you, in I, in the one I. And what is that little oscillation back and forth? If I start going with nama rupa, name and form, I'll say, well, this is a mouse. I use it to navigate with a cursor on the computer. And it has such and such a design, and it's connected with the electrical nature of my computer, and there are indicator lights, and there are different wheels on it to help me navigate. That's in the realm of relationship and quality. But the isness of the mouse, and the isness of my pitch pipe are, if you could see it, they're identical, even though qualitatively they are different. So can you feel the difference of a thing as it seems to be, with all of its descriptions, all of its differentiation or differentiations? In other words, the many. And then can you feel that that is different from what I want to call the thing in you? So we'll ponder that a little. Now, sometimes inanimate objects work for some people. Sometimes when you ponder a person, it works better. Or, you know, maybe a member of the animal kingdom or a plant kingdom. It doesn't make any difference. Whatever works for you. How do you find that thing in you? I'm not saying this won't take work. I think it will take a lot of work. But then the turn will come, even for a split second. And if sometimes you take the object of your perception and you try to turn it into presence, I will put that down. Turn the object of your perception into pure presence. See, really, you know, if you practice, it's an old Jesuit thing, right? But practicing the presence of God is really practicing the presence of yourself. And that's worth considering. You know, you'd think that for people who try so hard to know what is the quality of anything, that this kind of approach would be something that is not germane to their spiritual pursuit. But I think it's extremely influential, basic, essential. When the flip comes, it's a flip, however you want to describe it. So that, you know, as in the Yoga Sutras, it talks about, which, by the way, the masters study, especially in the third and fourth book, they say it is the incorporation of the universe within yourself, something of that nature. It's an interiorizing of the universe. We learn to interiorize the universe. There's more to it, but let's begin with the universe. And that's when we begin to know that we are, as I sense, immortal. We'll meditate on this. When we can interiorize the universe so that anything perceived is really and truly the presence of ourselves, then we know what these words mean. Immortal. Immutable. Because non-divisible being is certainly immutable. You need division for mutability. And the one sort of non-thing that exists in universe and everywhere else is the great indivisibility. For relativity, you need divisibility. Relativity requires divisibility. And maybe I can put that in parenthetically down here, that about spelling, huh? Little mantra. The true individual, the true individual is indivisible. So when we can interiorize, let's say, you know, at first, whatever we perceive in the universe and finally the universe itself, we become the indispensable. Because there's nothing else. The irreplaceable. Because there's nothing else. The ineradicable, because it takes another to eradicate anything. This is a good one, I think, the inextinguishable. Now, you know, bear in mind, I'm not talking about something remote. I'm talking about you and me. I'm talking about what we really are. Inextinguishable. The in destructible that would involve fragmentation, wouldn't it? And you'd have to have a destroying agent that doesn't exist. The inexhaustible. It's the very archetype of endless presence. If presence is forever, without beginning and without end, and always at the same level of reality, how do you exhaust presence? You may cognize it on any particular day in a greater or lesser manner, but you don't exhaust it. It is the one substance, the one substantiality. And in the same way, indefatigable. And invincible, unconquerable. It always requires that other source or entity to act upon presence. But there is none. The absoluteness is, well, you really, you know, words are, we're told, beyond the reach, it's all beyond the reach of any word or thought, but you can indicate, you can hint, you can, you, just like faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen, you can put yourself in rapport with this one substandingness, which is, or substance, which is greater than any finite universe. Now remember, this is, you know, we take a little vacation from illusion here. This is about you forever. All these. Are about you forever. And without a starting point, without an ending point. So, you know, I might like say, hey, your homework for today is to internalize the universe. You know, homework for how many lives or cycles will it take? Our homework in universe is to internalize that universe. And, you know, I have a few just little mantras. You could repeat the word, or you could say, I am immortal, and you can dwell with this. But what in you is immortal? It's not the shape of the causal body, is it? It's not any vehicle, is it? What is immortal is the presence that you are. And the only thing that I think cannot exist. And, you know, I have to think this through, but you, what you really are, the essence, the absolute, can never be absent. It can seem to be absent, but as a presence, the super universal presence, it is never absent. This, what we are talking about here, we are talking about a factor, I don't know what to call it, factor thing, you know, you can't really factor, which is never absent. That seems to be the one limitation upon possibility, that the absolute zero should somehow be nothing. It is no thing, but it can never be nothing, as far as I can understand at present. So basically, it says here, take time with each word. See if you can understand why the all-pervasive self-identical you-ness, which is the core of the one I-ness in universe, it is, which is foundational to each instance of an infinitude of sequential universal logoi, and the universe's derivative from each such universal logos. See if you can understand why these words apply. You know, basically, in this work we're doing here, it's about deepening our sense of identity and being, expanding it, deepening it. That's what we're doing. We're living beyond our skin, in a way. We're living beyond the customary ring pass knot. So live beyond the customary RPN. So let's see if we can, at some point, instead of looking at our mortality, at our mutability, at our dispensability, our replaceability, our eradicability, our extinguishability, our destructibility, our exhaustibility, our defaticability, and our vulnerability, conquerability, that we realize those things, those states, to be illusory and only operative in that self-perception we call a universe. Sometimes you see these quite happy Buddhas, you know. They look like they've eaten too well. And they're very joyous. And they're dancing or whatever they're doing. And they seem to have realized something. Maybe something that the average disciple or aspirant or even average initiate has not realized. And I contend that what they have realized is on the level of ontology. It's all about who they really are and what's really happening. And the kind of permanence of it all, the ongoingness of it all. Yes, there are rest periods of all in allness, but all this has been mahamayavically going on forever. So we are happy about that. Joyous, blissful, whatever we want to call it. And is it too big a stretch? Well, it's a big stretch to go from our studies in the realm of relations, very necessary studies in the great science of relations. It's a really, it's almost, could say it's an infinite leap. On the other hand, it does seem to be a fundamental goal of any emanation eventually. We don't expect that in universes past, this little encapsulation of the one self that we seem to be is going to be found. It's not going to be found. The only thing that will be found is the one identity, and we had best learn how to identify as that which we have ever been. So that's how to spend a few minutes a day interiorizing the universe and being what you're seeing, as it were. From one point of view, you aren't what you see, and from another point of view, you are. Breathing in the essence of all perceptions. That's what I think is really important, to do that. Breathe in the essence of all perceptions. And don't just let them be things out there. There's nothing out there at all. It's all an interior experience of one actor, one being. And and no one can escape from that eventually when we understand. That's a long way from the average consciousness, okay? Obviously. There's a lot of people for whom this is total nonsense, because it flies in the face of what is considered to be reality. But when you have had quite a few lives as a human being, you begin to wake up to the larger possibilities, and it serves as a foundation to hold you up in the midst of overwhelming variety. It's a bit like a pedal tone, sometimes in the Indian music, you just have that pedal going, and even in the Indian, in the Sanskrit script, there is this bar from which all the different letters descend. If there is a ground of all being, shared by all things. We want to know about it, and we want to identify as it. We'll just reach out to each other, you know, as some few of us here, those that can stand it, and see it as one thing, maybe a number of people, but basically one essence. Then you will see that it's impossible to lose anyone or lose anything, and it's impossible to lose the real self that you are. You just cannot lose it, because it's the only thing in town, you know. Okay, that'll be so. If you have any thoughts or questions on the subject, we can get into it, or other things on occultism. I'm not going to go on too long today. There is this new moon meditation coming up, and then an esoteric United Nations discussion and meditation. So there are other things to deal with today, and we will, you know, defer the reappearance of the Christ meditation. But, you know, there was a time when the Christ in India, he knew all these things. He still does know them. And he was part of that great Vedantic movement, I do believe. And I do believe his name was Maitreya, and or Maitreyi. It's hard to know whether a man or a woman, but this kind of teaching does render one more responsive to the teaching on love and service. It's not just out there. It's so in there that the love and service become a natural response. So, okay, I certainly haven't gone over everything I sent you last week, but a little something. And if there's anybody that has anything that you want to say, then, or to write, then you can do that now.
And I am looking for any hands raised or questions, comments written in the chat box.
And, you know, I would just say for a moment that, you know, every time you take a breath or a deep breath, think about that possibility of breathing the universe into your own being. So that will take us on the way towards this interiorization of the universe, which is a desirable objective. It will really change our perception to infuception, and it will change a lot of things. And I think we'll come closer and closer to knowing what the initiate consciousness actually is. Right now we talk a lot about it, but it's possible to get into it. And that will be a desirable, of course. So is there anybody that has anything you want to ask or say, or is there anything in the field of occultism for a little while that you want to deal with? We can do that. Or not.
Well, we could say that this whole study is a study of the law of correspondence being like an inexact detailed reflection. And we can look first within our own form and consider the entire form a universe in relationship to a single cell anywhere within that form.
Yes, I think, we can do that. And then, you know, what is the pervading consciousness of all of these different atomic lives and molecular lives and cellular lives? It is pervaded by the life of the particular organism we're talking about. It could be a human being like ourselves or whatever. So I think we can apply the law of correspondences. The issue here is that this type of teaching eradicates the sense of difference. We live on difference. We identify ourselves, Joe, there's Susan, there's Sally, whatever, you know. We differentiate and must in the universe. But what about the mode of non-differentiation? See that. Now, maybe, you know, in our life, there is not that thirst for non-differentiation. I know I've gone through periods of my life when all I could do was take things apart, analyze them down to the nth degree, you know, more and more minute. Or interactive, and I was interested in, and still am, in all the interactivity in the great science of relations. But, and it's hard to forget that. It's hard to suspend that for a little while. You know, we're just so used to it. To live in the world of the many, the world of the differential. We've been doing it forever, cyclically. So it's hard to look for the simplicity of sameness and actually find it, you know, in the heart and in the breath and in an ability to overlook variety, or at least not be captured by variety. That doesn't mean that you will not be proficient in detecting variety when you enter a different mode of mind. You may be very proficient in all of the minute studies. You may be, you know, just a fine scientist or philosopher or, you know, someone who knows how everything interacts, but also there is the need to know how nothing interacts, because it's all the same thing. It's all the essence. I remember how the divine Pimander, you know, supposedly the author is Hermes Trismegistus. I don't think so, but I think the students of his in Neoplatonic days carried on the tradition. And right at the very beginning, it talks about the only one thing. And I suppose all of the chemical and physical transformations, alchemical, that is, that are going to come from the only one thing.
You know, there's also a great law of separateness, which is essential for the involutionary cycle or portion of the cycle to occur. And once we've gone beyond the involutionary portion of the cycle into the evolutionary portion of the cycle, we must detach from that law and find our true self.
Yes, yes. You know, what do they say in alchemy? Separate followed by coagulate. You know, it's a descent and a reascent. The descent is differentiated, or using the mode of differentiation, and the ascent is amalgamative. And so, you know, these things make sense in terms of universal process. I guess, you know, if we could lift the veil sufficiently, we would come in touch with the raw fact of being. The raw fact. I ran into that phrase a long time ago, and I don't know that I ever really understood it until maybe more recently. But I'm interested in the flip between differential studies and, what should I call it, oneness studies, sameness studies, the studies of non-mutable being, the boundless immutable principle, non-mutable, because non-divided. So you just have to see whether something in you calls to you amidst all of your other studies and practical service applications to slip into this presence. And if it does, you know, you will find a way. You will find a way not only to find that presence, but to be that presence. You will find the method, the way of recognizing.
And we have a comment from Anna, writing, "So for the enjoyment of God, we need to learn to live in the presence of God, have conversation with God. The practice of the presence of God is a progressive understanding and acceptance of God's way, with the parallel understanding and rejection of self, little s, way."
Yes, and with that I basically agree, adding to it one factor, that of course God is not other. And the presence of God is the presence of the self, that you and I and all beings are. See, what we have to do, and it goes so much against the way we normally think, we start normally with dichotomization. We split and then continue to split on the basis of the first split until we have differentiated into the multitude. But we must realize, I think, anyway, you know, from my perspective, that God, whatever higher being, is not essentially other than ourselves, not essentially other than the one self. Naught is but me. Naught. Naught is but me. Not God, not anything other. And of course, that would be a great problem for many thinkers to say you and God are the same. But essentially, I do believe it to be the case, and I believe the ancient Vedantins and Brahmins, I think they found this out, they captured it, you know. In the Upanishads, they captured it, and they knew. So I'm in agreement with everything you're saying there, with that one addition, that what we're looking for is God as self and self as God. And there's no inflation in this whatsoever. There's no egotism in it. It's just the ability to recognize that there is a oneness, and it's an indivisible oneness at its most essential level. Later, under the spell of Mahamaya or illusion, it divides, subdivides, and you have all the many, 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 which are actual and necessary to deal with, but are essentially illusory. So we'll take the Jesuit practice a little bit farther and say that we're looking for the presence of the self. Thank you, Anna. And what is that, Catherine? Let's see. Michael, are you there? Am I talking to the...
Yeah, that is Catherine, and you should be able to unmute yourself, Catherine.
Let's see, okay. I see that. There you
Hello?
Go. Okay, you're good.
This is not on a...
You're good. You're good.
You can hear me? Okay,
you
great. this is probably the only forum that I could probably say this, but and I might have told you once a long time ago, but it's a little story. When I was about 2.5 years old, I was running along the street and I passed a white picket fence. And the light was shining on the white picket fence. And with the motion of me running along and the light on the white picket fence, I left my body. And I found myself sort of hovering above my body, and I could see myself, and still to this day is as clear as anything, with my little blue and white checkered bib and brace with a little yellow duck on the front. And I remember it exactly, you know. Then I thought something, and the thought was a mature-minded thought in my head. And as I was looking at myself, but the thought was actually in my head as a 2.5-year-old, and I thought... I am all that exists, and everything else is here to be in my way, and so I'm not so lonely. And I always felt a bit uncomfortable to actually tell anybody that, but I think it might be this solorism, you know, the one alone, you know, this whole, you know, you know, this whole where, you know, I'm everything and everything is in me and stuff like that. And yeah, so I thought it's a funny thought sort of thing to tell anybody.
Very, very important, you know, when those moments come, and maybe they are relatively rare in life, when one actually slips out of the body and identifies as a different kind of observer. You know, it sounded like you were abstracted into a mature soul consciousness, and that you saw the vehicle that you were going to be using in that particular incarnation. As I recall, you've got a lot of Aquarius and Aries. Do you have Gemini in your chart too?
Moon, Gemini.
Oh,
Aries, Sun, Aquarius Ascendant, Gemini, Moon.
Right, right. That, you know, when we have those out-of-the-body experiences, it is a promise that the kind of density of our normal life is essentially illusory, and that there are other ways of being and looking and being elevated. And, you know, it's a great bringer of confidence in the long run, because we get buried in the material environmental considerations, and we may tend to forget those little moments when we are abstracted, truly abstracted from the vehicular limitations. And so, you know, that kind of it sounds to me, you know, that was abstraction into soul consciousness. And it can stand as a safeguard. It would, for many people, stand as a safeguard from the despair of just being the body and a mortal figure appearing and disappearing almost nonsensically. Why, you know, a foreverness behind you, a foreverness ahead of you, in which you don't participate because you're simply some kind of physical organism. No, those things go out the window when you have one of these experiences. The word would be solipsism. Now, as I say, it doesn't have a good reputation, but I like to call it enlightened solipsism. You know, it's got the word SOL in it, doesn't it? You know, so the solo. I don't think that we can achieve that integrative meditation called isolated unity, which is the property of any master, unless we have the unity of point of view, the solipsistic point of view, the ability to isolate the one while in the midst of the many. And if we have that, it's a real treasure, a real psycho-spiritual treasure, if we can isolate the one in the midst of the ever mutating variety around and within us. So thanks for that story. It sounds like it's good. It's a safeguard. It's a point of reference. You know, it's good. Thank you.
And just a little phrase that came up to me at the beginning of the session was, there is no end in sight. And it can be insight or...
Insight. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, I find, I've been thinking about this kind of thing that you're bringing up, that endlessness is easier for me to deal with than beginninglessness. Mm. You know?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, everything seems to have a cause. But what do you do with that presence, which simply always has been, regardless of division and variety and number, it has no cause because there's nothing else to cause it. So that's tougher, I find, to kind of take that in, because what it has some implications which are difficult, because it basically means you've arrived at a certain point in this universe, let's just say, and the universe, this particular universe, is up for demonstration. But how did we get there? Because every universe is infinitely preceded, and there's no such thing, unless you have a beginning point, there's no way to move to any other definite point. I'm still working on that one, and it probably is going to mean, it's going to be the elimination of time and space is probably what will be the result of all that, the superimposition of all things in beingness. Now, if 5 universes ago, I can reach the present universe, but what happens in a state of beginninglessness with regard to emerging universes? Every universe is a point that can't be reached in a linear manner. That's what I'm trying to say. The linearity of going from A to B to C needs a starting point. And without that starting point, you're not even here, and yet you are. So, there are some paradoxes that have to be dealt with. And the old Vedantins, I think they said some outrageous things. They say, well, the universe never arose, really. And I said, well, this is nonsense. How are they getting this? But I'm beginning to understand that when you think into it deeply enough, linearity is an illusion, especially if there's no dimension, no dimension of time and space. And then how do you create a line of events? I'm not a mathematician, but there is a problem that some of the greatest mathematicians have tried to solve. It's called the problem of the continuum. Maybe how many points are there on a line, or how do you move from point A to point B to point C, and what are the numbers that are involved in the continuum? And it seems no one can solve it, probably because it is ultimately an illusory problem, and probably because with Parmenides, pre-Socratic philosopher, we're going to have to say, well, this is being and nothing moves. And there are no isolated events of any specific duration in the world of reality. Anyway, those are some of the problems that I thought I would spare everybody for a while until we get into them. We will at some point. So thanks, Catherine, for your thoughts and, for the experience that helps us live a more spiritual life.
And then Roz writes, when people have these spiritual insights, there seems to be light involved in the spiritual experience.
Yes. DK would probably say it involves the quality of the brain cells, or the phenomenology of the brain apparatus, that some people are truly intuitive who have no light in the head experience. But for others, yes, just as you say, the light increases, and you look around yourself and you find light bodies, not just opaque forms. Now, in the psychology book, basically, there is, under the technique of fusion, 3 techniques. And when you are a first-ray type, a second-ray quality of illumination results. When you are a second-ray type, a third-ray quality of imagination results. And when you are on the third ray, I'm talking about, you know, at a high level, we go back to the first ray, and the presence of power is experienced. So I would say that there are people for whom the light definitely increases, and others, at least at the beginning of their quest, may not get that light at all and yet be truly understanding and intuitive. It just depends on the quality, in this case, of the brain cells. You might want to look that up under the techniques of fusion in Esoteric Psychology, Volume 2. Somewhere in the late 300s, you can find all that. And thank you. Anything else?
No hands raised and no additional comments or questions written in the chat box at this point.
I mean, I know I'm taking you here on a bit of an adventure, you know, where are we really going? Well, you know, in a way, we're going nowhere. And there's no such thing as a individual unit moving through time and space. All of that is Mahamaya, the great illusion. So I'm trying to take us to the point where we realize something of the dynamics of that illusion. Now, you know, Shankara, he gives a big vote of confidence to Maya. He says, most mysterious is Maya and forever. Okay, and there is a great initiative, the sixth degree, saying that most mysterious is Maya and forever. So we just have to accept that there are many things that we're not going to understand for a long time, but we can begin to get an indication of what oneness really means. And beyond that, if we can differentiate, and we can talk about that, what zeroness means, if you can contrast it with oneness. Now, Blavatsky actually brings this up, the differences between the realm of number and no number. And, you know, there's a lot hidden, a lot of perplexity, you might say, when we go after what's called the realm of no number, the realm of the zero, which is not nothing. You know, once we're into the realm of number, we can divide at our leisure. The number one can give birth to everything, all the numbers. But how does the zero, or the zeronad, as I've been calling it lately, you know, how does that zeronad, the absolute zero, in the realm of no number, give birth to number? And that's something that in esoteric philosophy we may want to apply ourselves to, not that we'll know for sure, but by thinking about something even a little bit, there is a greater indication than if we had just accepted it because someone said so. Okay, Roz, thank you. And okay, so is that it then?
It
looks like it.
It seems to be it.
Okay. All right, well then remember, everybody, that we'll have a kind of a new moon in Virgo meditation And it actually, I think, I forget the exact time of the new moon, but we're beginning at 10 GMT or a little after. And the new moon is more like 11 GMT and maybe a few seconds. And a powerful impact can come along the line of the particular sign in question. Maybe we'll solve the mystery of the or the riddle of the Sphinx today, or something like that. You know, the head of the woman, the body of the lion. So we will see how we can apply it, because it is a practical sign, and we want to have that energy available for the purification of the nations, ourselves, our groups, our nations, our continents, and all of humanity. We want that Virgoan purification to occur. Okay, I'll keep sending, you know, as long as I have endurance, I will continue to send to you these daily seeds, you know, sometimes really simple and sometimes a little more complex. And here is our great invocation. I always try to show it because I myself sometimes forget verses. It's, you know, after you've done it just thousands and thousands of times, you can slip, you know. So, great invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Thank you, everyone, and we'll be in touch with you, some of you anyway, at the new moon meditation, and then later maybe at the EUN. Okay, so many blessings, lots of love, and we'll talk to you a little later. So I will stop the recording, and then, Michael, you can sign us off. Here goes the stop.